It's just past 8:35 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront on KPFA. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeker. Kat Brooks is out for the remainder of this week, but you are listening to a conversation she had and recorded before she left town. Her guest is Charlene Carruthers, founding national director of the Black Youth Project 100. Just out with the book, Unapologetic, A Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements. Back to the interview.
And so, what am I if I'm doing this thing? This word is out here. This organizer word is out here. Mm-hmm. What's not out there at the level that it should be is actual support for people to develop themselves as leaders, mm-hmm. which is hard to do in rapid response moments, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. And there have been moments and opportunities to do it. So, like, one of the things that came to me, I think, like, after writing the book, or maybe towards the end, was actually like doing something about my frustration and knowing that organizations, even BYP 100, did not have the capacity to do all the training that its members actually needed. Mm-hmm. Like, it's impossible for most organizations to do that. And so I started to build a new organization called the Chicago Center for Leadership and Transformation. And we're building an organization to help to really add real capacity to movements by building strong leaders for transformative social justice movements. And so our goal is to really help to provide some of that capacity that we know our movement needs in this moment, mm-hmm. for leadership development. And it's one thing to just, like, you know, talk about it, and it's another to actually do something about it. And so I consider the Chicago Center to be a part of a much broader ecosystem of training and capacity building organizations to actually meet the needs of our movements today.
Yeah, thank you for all that. Because I think what scares me is, mm-hmm. you know, I often refer to organizing, it's an art form, right? Mm-hmm. And it's something that we are trained to do. Mm-hmm. And this is such a critical moment. Mm-hmm. That I fear what we lose if we don't develop folks in that way.
Oh, for sure. I think the concern is extremely valid, and I've seen it show up in real ways in movement. I think also, like, a lot of folks, especially in moments of, like, deep crisis, who do rise to the occasion are thrown so much. Mm-hmm. They're thrown so much, and they have to figure out how to do something. They're thrusted into the limelight, thrusted into making decisions with very little infrastructure for them to tap into. And I do think there are organizations like Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity, BOLD, mm-hmm. that has been here, Center for Third World Organizing, the Highlander Center, the Blackout Collective. They're different bodies or different organizations, and they're not enough. Right. Even adding the Chicago Center, as I'm building it out, it is not going to be enough. We need so many more. We need so much more.
Yeah, and I think that's why I started, and I'm going to move on, but I think that's why I started by sort of saying, right, and I put that on, at least in California, like myself and other folks that have been in the movement for a minute that, you know, and have organization, like, we're not doing enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're living in very intense times because we're doing everything else.
That's right.
So the term anti-blackness has been thrown around a lot in the last few, mm-hmm. years. And what do we mean? What do you mean by that? And from your perspective, because I really appreciate how you lay this out in the book, where did anti-blackness in America start, Charlene?
Oh, where did anti-blackness in America start? I mean, well, we can just start with, you know, the first set of slave ships that came over here. And how the people of the colonies had to figure out how to justify their barbaric means of controlling labor, both here in, like, and I would say, like, the Americas, right? So here in the United States of America and the Caribbean, Central America, South America, like, all of those places, they had to, they made a choice to use anti-black devices to control people and to justify the terrible violence that they enacted upon people. And so when I think, so much goes back to that time and that moment, or those many moments And also, like, it isn't just something that happened, you know, 400 years ago. It's something that has evolved and morphed and all of those things over the years. And anti-blackness is codified in U.S. like policy, and it has been, be it from the black codes, or be it from redlining, or be it from the 1994 crime bill, Joe Biden and co, be it the personal responsibility welfare act, like all those things enable, like they rely on these specific how I define it in the book is that anti-blackness is a system of beliefs and practices that destroy, erode, and dictate the humanity of black people. And so it's both beliefs and practices. There are people and there are institutions that operate through this idea that not are only black people just not full human beings, but we there's something inherently wrong with us. Mm-hmm. Something criminal, something profane, something deviant, as Kathy Cohen would note, the deviancy of blackness. And, you know, blackness in more ways than one, I talk about in the book, is queer. And by queer, I mean super expansive, mm-hmm. very expansive, deviant. Not what is considered normal by dominant forces. And so anti-blackness shows up in people of color organizations and organizing in implicit ways and explicit ways. I think, and it could be perceived as implicit. And I actually think, like, y'all should know better because we said it. And you've been told this thing. So it's not just you're just implicitly doing this or whatever. Mm-hmm. It shows up in black organizations as well. I think particularly, like, things just start to get real muddy, or they can get muddy when we're doing, like, because blackness is not a monolith, as many people will say. Like, we come from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And we come with all of our stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's something that's super important for us to, like, so when I talk about the black queer feminist lens, it's literally like when you put on a pair of glasses, a pair of sunglasses, a prescription vision glasses, they impact the way you see the world. And so having a lens that allows you, or like requires you, to consider the role of anti-blackness in your own life, in the work that you're doing, and in the world, it then requires you to see things differently, hopefully seek out a lot more complete stories about the conditions of people, and then ideally lead you to more complete solutions to actually end the suffering of people. I see it as a part of a web of systems, including capitalism, patriarchy, and white supremacy.
One of the other things that you talk about in the book is again something I really resonated with. But you know, sort of in the last few years of the I don't know, I think around 2014, I guess, and I believe it came out of, you know, the work that was being done by young activists in Ferguson, was this phrase, "This isn't your grandparents' civil rights movement."
Oh yeah.
And that, like, literally used to make me twitch. In fact, we were at a conference, mm-hmm. and they were in the audience, and I said that, mm-hmm. that, like, I mm-hmm. found that, you know, statement, it bothered me, right? And mm-hmm. it bothered me because I'm like, you're right, we're not being lynched, bombed, thrown into lakes, you know, attacked by fire hoses or eaten by dogs, was sort mm-hmm. of my thing. We had a really great principled struggle conversation around it, but you've come to agree, and I would love for you to just sort of lay out your thinking.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I mean, I started in a very similar place as you. I was like, wait, what? Like, it felt like really disrespectful to me. It felt like it was like a throwing away what our folks have been through before us. And as I thought about it more, I was like, you know, we are living in a different political and economic context in this moment. Mm-hmm. The organizations that were dominant or led in those days are not the same organizations today. Leading in the movements that, you know, the movements that we're talking about, they're not leading. The things we're talking about, it's not that they've never been talked about before. We're not the first people to talk about these things. I think that we are talking about these things at a different scale. And they're more visible, and largely in part because people, like, They got the water ready for us. Like they were working on it before us. Mm-hmm. And the state is at a different level of power, with technology and surveillance. It's a different ball game in many ways. That's and so true. I think it's, when I think of it not being like our grandfather's civil rights movement, it should be less about like how radical they were or how so-called respectable they were. Mm-hmm. And more about, let's talk about how actually this isn't like the world of your grandfather's civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Like that's to me closer to where we are.
I can rock with that. Okay. You did something that is highly recommended, but not done very often, and certainly not done as quickly as you did it. And what I mean by that is you rejected founder syndrome, and you built up this amazing national organization, BYP 100, and bounced. And now you founded the Chicago Center for Leadership and Transformation. And I guess it's a two-part question. You know, one is what all went into the decision to leave the organization. And then I want to sort of close out by the work that you are doing, hope to do with the Chicago Center for Leadership and Transformation.
Yeah. So some BYP 100 members would joke and say she's been planning to leave since she got there. But I knew that BYP 100 was a young people's organization, and that it needed to be led by young people, and that people can become dinosaurs in doing youth or young people's organizing. Mm-hmm. And I did not want to become that. And I think that organizations can become stagnant when they don't get new leadership and new ideas, different approaches, all of those things. And so I originally planned on leaving in 2017. And it was actually a conversation with a comrade, Paris Hatcher, that made me think a little differently. Because at the time, we didn't have like a strategic plan for the organization. And we didn't have like other things in place that needed to be in place before I left. So, and the last 25% that convinced me was when 45 was elected. And I was like, oh, right now in 2016, this isn't the exact time to leave. So I'm going to give it 1 year into this person's presidency, and then I'll leave. And so I formally announced to the staff in like the winter of 2017 that 2018 would be my last year. And so we spent a year on that whole process. And it was just super important to me to do it in a principled way and a responsible way. Mm-hmm. Our two new co-directors, Janae Bonsu and Deatra Jackson, it was no surprise to me that they were the new co-directors or they were going to be the new co-directors. I was involved in the process, but I wasn't like the only person making the decision. And one of them I helped develop as a leader, and the other I don't know when I met her, some years ago. I've been watching her and been very interested in her coming into this leadership role for years. Mm-hmm. Years. And so there was intentionality. And I mean, we told the organization like a year before, hey, if you're interested in being a national director, let us know so we can help you get there. So it was not ever like an underground process to pick the next people. And so as I think about my work now and how I what is most important to me, leadership development remains one of the most important things to me. And then also being rooted in Chicago is very important to me. So starting the Chicago Center, for short, the Chicago Center for Leadership and Transformation, is really about building a locally rooted learning community that's connected to people across the country and across the globe for folks who are invested in building transformative social justice movements. And so I'm really, really invested in Black, Brown, AAPI folks and Indigenous folks and as leaders. And doing what we can and doing what I can to like shore up our capacity to do the work that we need to do, because it has to even go beyond just a group of people in the room who know how to train or facilitate and really like do some replicable work. So that's what we're up to. And we're going to be doing some fun things around strategic communications, around foreign language instruction, because that's one of the biggest barriers, I think, to Black folks being able to do transnational work. And even for Black folks being able to do work across communities in the U.S. for those of us who only speak English.
Right.
And so, and of course, political education and grassroots organizing training. So that's what I'm up to. And we're on Facebook right now, and the website will launch next month. We have an event. We have our launch event on June 15th here in Chicago. But for now, folks can check us out on Facebook.
Wonderful. Charlene Carruthers, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
We have been speaking to Charlene Carruthers about her relatively new book, Unapologetic, A Black Queer Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements. Charlene is a Black lesbian feminist who spent over a decade developing leaders as an effective strategist, community organizer, and educator. She is the former founding national director of BYP 100, Black Youth Project 100, and now the current founding director of the Chicago Center for Leadership and Transformation.